I'm Dr. Leif Tappanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History. I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho. This is The Nature of Idaho. Coming from the 1B, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today, our guest is research ecologist Dr. Matt Germino from the U.S. Geological Survey in Boise, and we'll be talking about alpine trees and their adaptations to survive at high altitude.
First, let's get into a little bit of nature news, Leif. According to a Dartmouth College study, climate change and the loss of wetlands could possibly contribute to increased levels of mercury concentration in coastal fishes.
Uh-oh.
Yes, so mercury is a metal, and it's a bioaccumulator. It doesn't go away. It stays in the environment, and it stays in the animal that eats it.
Right. And once an animal consumes it, I believe it gets stored in its fatty tissues.
Yes,
and
it
doesn't leave. Right?
It doesn't leave. So that means if we eat the fish, guess what we're accumulating?
Mercury is not a great thing to eat.
Mercury is not a great thing to eat. So what they've realized is that as the global climate changes and we have increased rain events, some of these massive rain events, and you combine that with land use changes, such as the removal of wetlands for agriculture purposes or urbanization, you are getting these massive runoffs of soil into streams and rivers that eventually work their way down into the coastal estuaries and bays. Fish then are now being exposed to greater amounts of mercury, and we've got animals, other larger fish and marine mammals that will come in and feed off of these fish that then we turn around and will eat mainly fish. And we are then accumulating mercury.
That's not a good news story.
That is not a good nature news story. And it goes to show when we look at conservation and we look at Idaho in general, especially wetlands, they are fantastic water cleaners and sponges for sediment and other types of materials we don't necessarily want in our water. The sad part is they tend to be where everyone wants to move.
Hopefully we can get our hands around this problem, right? And because we like our fish here in Idaho.
And we love our water.
Absolutely. Well, you know, today, like every day, we try to have a little trivia, a little fun fact for the day. So today, going in theme with today's show, we're going to be asking about the oldest tree in Idaho and what species it is. Where can I find that oldest tree in Idaho? Well, after the break, we'll meet a person who can tell us the answer to that question. We'll be right on back to have our interview.
KISU works hard to ensure the reliability of our FM signal, but occasionally, seasonal weather or equipment failures cause us to go off the air. Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org, or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Well, welcome back. I want to welcome our guest today, Matt Germino. I want to thank him for joining us here at The Nature of Idaho. You know, one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to Matt today, it comes from a weekend excursion. I was up at Pebble Creek Ski Area, and it was snowing, and it was a little foggy up at the top of the mountain, and I was pointing out to my son, we were skiing at the top of the hill, and we were admiring the trees that were just crusted over with snow and looked like such a harsh place to live. And I met Matt a long time ago, and I figured this is a perfect guy to talk about trees and the wilderness that we see at the top of mountains. So Matt, welcome to the show. Let's talk about alpine trees.
Great, thanks for having me.
Well, so what can you tell us about life at the top of the mountain? Obviously it's cold up there. I know the air is a little thinner. What's the challenges posed to a plant if it's trying to make its to survive up at the top of the mountain?
Mm-hmm. Well, the primary problem or challenge that the plants face is that their growing season is very short. So at the top of Pebble Creek ski area, for example, the growing season might not start until maybe the first week of June or so, and it could be over before the end of October. At even higher elevations, you know, if you go to some of the larger mountains in Idaho, the growing season window is even shorter. And, you know, interestingly, all that snow that you see and the ice or rime ice that you sometimes see trees caked in is not necessarily a bad thing, because snow, it can form an insulative blanket that actually protects the trees or any other kind of vegetation from the piercing cold temperatures that you get at those very high elevations.
Right, right. So is there an adaptation for trees to try to accumulate more of that material?
Oh, absolutely. So it's really useful to think about how trees change as you go up in elevation. So if you think about what a normal forest looks like with, you know, large timbered trees fairly densely clustered together, you know, at a given elevation, a middle elevation. Now, if you go up in elevation, you start having large meadows that, within that tree, within that forest. And then at even higher elevations, now the trees become islands within a mosaic of meadows. So it flips. Now, instead of having meadows in the forest, at higher elevation, you've got islands of trees. And at even higher elevations, now the trees start to get smaller in stature, and they might even start looking a bit shrubby. And at the very highest elevations that trees occur, they typically will have a form that we call Krummholz. It's spelled Krummholz, and it's the German word that means twisted wood. And Krummholz is a very special adaptation in which the leaves, the little evergreen conifer needles, are rather small and very densely clustered together. And then the stems are also clustered together. And that all helps to trap the snow and thereby protect the leaves from those piercing cold temperatures. So oftentimes, well, people will look at those shapes of the trees and say, well, geez, the low temperatures must cause the trees to not be able to grow any smaller. Well, actually, the shrubby form has an adaptive value by allowing the plants to, first of all, stay out of to avoid the harsh blowing winds, and then secondly, to retain the snow and benefit from this nice insulation blanket that snow provides.
So as we go up in an elevation, the types of trees change too, correct? So when we're down in the lower elevations, we've got the meadows and we've got deciduous trees everywhere. What happens as we go up in elevation to the types of trees that you find?
Mm-hmm. So a typical elevation gradient for much of Idaho might be Douglas fir and, you know, ponderosa pine at the lowest elevations. A little bit higher up, you might have lodgepole pine and limber. A little bit higher up, you start getting into subalpine fir, Engelmann spruce, and at the various highest elevations, white bark pine is common. And subalpine fir and Engelmann spruce happen to be some of the best well-adapted species globally for forming Krummholz. White bark pine, interestingly, it can occur in a shrubby-like form, but interestingly, it doesn't form a classic Krummholz shape to it. But anyways, white bark pine is kind of interesting because it is also very sensitive to pathogens, and we're seeing it being lost from many Idaho mountaintops. leaving only the Engelmann spruce and subalpine fir.
It's interesting. So obviously these are all conifer species that are living at these very high elevations and can adapt to those climatic extremes. Can you explain in a simple way why the flowering plants and deciduous trees don't survive to the same extent, or maybe there are some that do?
Well, they do in other tree lines elsewhere around the globe. So if you go to lower latitudes, for example, down in Chile, there's a tree species called Polylepis that is an evergreen broadleaf that occurs at tree line. Also in Hawaii, the ohia tree grows from sea level all the way up to nearly 14,000 feet elevation at tree line. So why are our tree lines here in the Rocky Mountains and Idaho, why are they dominated by evergreen conifers and not broadleaves? Well, I don't think anybody has a great definitive answer to that. It probably relates a little bit to the seasonality and the continentality of our climates. Here in the Rocky Mountains, for example, we happen to in addition to having severe wintry winters, we also have long day summers where water deficit can become a problem for plants. So interestingly, these high mountains, they get a lot of precipitation and a lot of snow, but at the same time, the water drains away and we have warm, dry summers and seasonal drought can set in. We think that the waxy coating of the evergreen needles and their ability to use morphological adaptations to avoid drought somehow help them deal with our continental climate. And that, so continental means that, again, you get these seasonal extremes of harsh winters, but then also warm, dry summers. And that differs from a maritime climate, which is a little bit more temperate and tends to be a little wetter year-round.
So our trees have to be ready for just about anything.
That's correct, yeah.
Well, and you were talking initially about the very short growing season that a lot of these plants have to accomplish many great things. What are some of the adaptations that people have noticed about that short season and how they go about doing what needs to be done?
Well, they are very, first of all, they enter a period of deep dormancy to make it through the winter. They're able to quickly come out of that cold dormancy to utilize the spring runoff, the moisture that's available from the melting snow to do what we call photosynthesis and gain the carbohydrates that they need to grow. So having an ability to grow quickly when resources are available is what we think to be a key adaptation. They also, have adaptations in their reproduction. So reproductive problems are a key part of understanding tree lines, especially when you start to think about what it takes to get a new tree and therefore more trees in this environment. But to begin with, these trees are very good at storing resources from any given growing season. And when I say resources, I mean carbohydrates and lipids, oils, that are then later used to provide the energy to produce seeds. They might have seed production only once every 3 or so years. So during these short growing seasons, they're storing up their resources to invest those resources only occasionally into making new seeds and producing more trees.
So it sounds like we've got some really tough trees that are at the alpine level, but yet when we talked earlier, we're talking some of these trees are really sensitive to disease and pathogens. Mm-hmm. And as the alpine regions and our global climate is changing, how does this then affect our trees up there? And when we lose a species, there's always something else that comes in and fills that void. What's happening with the white pine, if we're losing them, is something mm-hmm. filling that void.
Right. So the current location of our alpine tree line, so alpine tree line just refers to the highest elevation limit of these trees. That elevation where we currently see tree line is actually probably something that was formed in a colder environment that occurred maybe 100 or so years ago. So trees are actually living, the trees at treeline are actually living in a warmer environment than they once did. And now what's happened is that pathogens such as the white pine blister rust or especially the pine beetles are able to occur at much higher elevations than they did, let's say, 20 years ago. And so, you know, 20 years ago, I never saw any pathogens at treeline affecting trees. Now it's actually rather common. White pine blister rust obviously affects white pines more than it does the other species. White pine, like white bark pine, is a colonizing species. We think that it was the first species to encroach or invade into the alpine meadows years ago. Once it got established, we think that it acted like a nurse plant, that it sheltered the ground around it in ways that benefited its subalpine fir and Engelmann spruce. Now that white pine is being lost from many of these tree-lined environments around Idaho and elsewhere, we're seeing that it's being replaced by the subalpine fir and Engelmann spruce, which interestingly are species that might not otherwise have been able to establish in some of these high tree-lined sites. So it's a very interesting scenario where your colonizing pioneer tree species is being lost and being replaced by the somewhat weaker, if you will, beneficiary species. Now, looking forward for climate change, you might expect that without white bark pine present, the responses of tree line to warming are probably going to be quite different moving forward than they were in the past when all species were present. It's kind of a complex idea, but I believe that it's really occurring here in Idaho.
How is the for those trees that are defining that tree line at high elevation? How is the environment shifting? How can we measure the shifts in environment? You mentioned it gets warmer. Are we seeing a difference also in amounts of snow precipitation and rain precipitation and the timing of melting?
Yes, there is. The reports I've read show that there is less snow in a general sense. And furthermore, snow melt is happening a little bit earlier, which you might think might benefit the trees at treeline because it would extend the growing season. And I remember I mentioned that was one of the primary constraints.
Right.
Well, there is a downside here, and the downside relates to the seasonal drought stress that I also mentioned. When you have a longer growing season, especially with a little bit less snow, you can expect that the trees will probably experience a little bit more drought stress. So you see there's this tension under a warming environment where on one hand, you may have a longer growing season, but on the other hand, that growing season has a little bit more drought in it. And our tree-lined trees aren't adapted to every kind of stress out there. They're better adapted to low temperature stresses than they are to drought. So some of the few studies that have tested the effects of global warming on tree lines have found that you may not always see tree line go higher in elevation in a warming environment. In fact, a number of publications suggest that you may actually see a contraction of forest with a lowering of the alpine tree line under a warmer environment.
So because these trees are really living, you know, as it is on the margin of what is survivable, that's sort of how I see a tree line. Obviously, they don't exist above it. And so you're looking at this edge. And as that edge changes in response to a changing environment, what's the value of these trees and measuring that tree line or observing changes in that tree line over time? How does that relate to the rest of the forest ecosystem that we that we derive so much value from?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, there's two ways of looking at this. People have been very interested in tree line for many years. It's actually one of the it's one of the longest standing subjects in ecological research going back hundreds of years. And first and foremost, people have always been interested in these environments because they're scenic and they're beautiful, and people are naturally have an affinity to them. But more pragmatically, to get to your point, Leif, these tree lines are thought to be a point of sensitivity in the relationship of forest to climate. In other words, we might be able to think of them as a bellwether. The tree lines are a very defined, narrow vegetation border where we might expect to see the early responses to climate change. For example, with more warming, perhaps you'll see a change in the number of little tree seedlings coming in between the sparsely spaced trees at tree line. And that early, what we call demographic change, could be an indicator of future impending changes in the forest that's next to the tree line. So in other words, tree line can be used as sort of a bellwether for the early impacts of climate change, and also as an indicator of general forest health. And so for that reason, tree lines have become a highly subscribed topic of research in ecology and land management.
So I know in many areas, and also including in our region, trees that live at high elevation or in colder temperatures sometimes are capable of living quite a long time. I'm wondering how somebody goes about measuring the age of a tree, especially these really high elevation trees that might not follow the same rules that we might think of the lower elevation trees.
And the other thing too is everyone goes, well, count the tree rings. If you've got a living tree, you don't want to cut it down to count the rings, right?
That would be a problem, right?
Yeah, well, fortunately, so in a regular forest, you can use a tree corer, which is basically you drill into the tree and you pull a core out that's about the diameter of a soda beverage straw. And you can count the number of tree rings. Well, that doesn't work so well at tree line because, like I said, the wood can be very twisted. It's very difficult to blindly core a tree and hit the center, the initial growth rings. Fortunately, there's lots of old dead wood in many tree lines in Idaho and elsewhere in the Rocky Mountains. And that the presence of those large downed trunks, by the way, is a great indication that at one point in the past, our forests occurred at a higher elevation than they do now. We think that, 500 to 1,000 years ago, during a geologic period known as the hypsothermal, the forests marched up higher in elevation, and then forests retreated during the Little Ice Age, and now the big question is, are the forests marching back uphill with the climate warming that we're having in the last century or so? And that's a hard problem. It's very difficult to actually get a definitive answer to that. But the good news is that we can take a chainsaw and cut cookies off of these large down trunks. We've done that in many number of tree lines, and it's not uncommon to count well over 1,000 tree rings, annual growth rings, on Engelmann spruce or subalpine fir trunks, meaning that those trees are that old, at least 1,000+ years.
That's amazing, and the possibility, therefore, is a tree of that age can record, you know, a 1,000 years of history of that spot on the earth, right? And it could be recording changes in the amount of water available to it, or potentially temperature. Can we track temperature off of that?
Absolutely. There's the widths of the growth rings in a wetter, warmer year, the growth rings tend to be a little bit wider, reflecting greater growth. Also, leaf there tends to be fire scars that are readily evident in these cookies that we've cut from the downed trees. So you can see a history of disturbance. And one lesson from that is fire disturbances have also changed immensely during the European colonization of the Western U.S., and that has probably affected these ecosystems in ways that we're only now beginning to understand.
Wow, this is fascinating stuff, Matt. I really want to thank you for giving us a little glimpse into how to understand these high alpine trees. Now, we started off with a trivia question, which, you know, comes to us from the Rocky Mountain Tree Ring Research Group. They have cored a tree, or maybe they cut a cookie to find out how many years of growth bands they could count. So I'm gonna ask you the question that we started off with, which is, where in Idaho would I find the oldest tree, and what species is it?
Well, it's in central Idaho near the town of Haley, and it's on a limber pine tree, which is closely related to whitebark pine, but occurs across many more elevation bands, including treeline. And that tree, the oldest one, is thought to be 1,700 years old.
That's phenomenal.
That's crazy when you think about it, yeah.
These old trees are the Methuselahs of our landscapes. They've seen it all.
Seen it all.
We'd like to thank Dr. Matt Germino, research ecologist from the U.S. Geological Survey in Boise, for joining us today. To learn more, please visit or Google USGS Forest and Rangeland Ecosystem Science Center. Shows are recorded here at the studios of KISU Pocatello. Visit us at KISU.org for questions, comments, and for audio of all our programs. Our theme music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock, and please remember to get outside and enjoy the nature of Idaho.